The local cops are very impressed by you. They're saying the guy you caught, the Dutchman, is a really big deal. He's not talking except to say how much he hates you. Kind of the same thing Bill Fiore was saying for a while. We both had a laugh at that. I said, what about Christoph's partner, Ollie, the sloppy guy I told you about? He's in the wind. We've got no idea who he is or where he went. Based on some of the details about Christoph, we're in touch with the Amsterdam police. They might have something on him. The flight itself was uneventful. I noticed that Natalie, wedged into the seat next to me, didn't want to venture too far on any topic. After everything she'd gone through, I could understand her feelings. She asked me why I really had started looking for her. My natural inclination is to always tell the truth, but this was a family issue, and I wasn't sure what was best for that family. Finally, I explained, I had a few problems on the job. I was in a shooting. Your dad thought it was best if I stayed off the streets in New York for a little while. He was worried about you, so I started looking. Not much more to tell.
What about your shooting? Is it resolved?
I don't know about officially, but there was plenty of video. I've been told I'm going to be cleared officially. She asked for the details. I said, I was up in the Bronx working at the site of the homicide of a nurse and her young daughter. It was horrific. I stepped outside to grab a Gatorade and two men confronted me with a gun. I shot one. The other, a guy named Tight, ran away. After looking at it more, we now think he might have been involved in the homicide of the nurse and her daughter. Oh, that sounds traumatic all around. That would keep me up at night the rest of my life. The thing that bothers me most is that Tight is still running free. I'd do anything to lay my hands on that guy. Natalie said, it's sad to say, but I don't know much about police work other than what I've seen on Law and Order. After watching you firsthand, I could tell you I could never be a cop. I laughed and said, that is the exact opposite of what most people think. The public believes they understand what a cop goes through, and everyone seems to have advice on how to do police work. I appreciate you admitting a blind spot.
Trust me, it's not a blind spot anymore. I'll never forget what you did for me.
She placed her hand on top of mine. It was one of the most sincere thank yous I had ever heard. Chapter 94. I watched the Manhattan skyline as a Lufthansa 747 landed at JFK. It was always good to get home. 20 minutes later, Natalie and I hurried down the jetway to the main terminal. I'm sure she never would have admitted it, but I could tell the young computer genius was excited about seeing her parents. I was just as excited to see my family. I noticed a group of official-looking people not far from the gate. They had a uniformed NYPD officer with them, probably to help them slip through security. Before we had even cleared the gate, an attractive woman in a smart pantsuit rushed forward and embraced Natalie. I hesitated, not wanting to intrude on the touching reunion. Natalie and her mother started to cry. As I continued to walk, Natalie reached out and grabbed me by the arm. She broke her embrace with her mother and said,
"This is the man who saved me. You have no idea what he risked looking for me in Estonia. We have to tell Dad about it right away."
The look on her mother's face told me everything I needed to know about the mayor at that moment. She turned to her daughter and said, in a soft voice,
"It'll have to wait. Your dad had an event he couldn't miss. He also didn't want to turn this into a media circus. We're all going to meet for dinner."
Now I felt like giving Natalie a hug. She looked more like a lost little girl at that moment than at any time during this investigation. Even after all of her talk about not caring what her father thought, she was devastated he hadn't come to the airport to welcome her home. She looked at her mother and said, "Dad didn't want a media circus because he doesn't want anyone to know about the mayor's wild daughter." She started to cry, but buried her face in her mother's shoulder. Her mother looked at me as she patted her daughter's head. She said quietly, "I don't know how we can ever thank you." Before I could even acknowledge her words, I heard a shriek and had just enough time to look up and prepare for Chrissy coming at me like a guided missile. As I suspected, she was followed in short order by Shauna,
Trent, and Fiona. I was lucky to stay on my feet. Before I could give these four the hugs they deserved, Mary Catherine appeared out of the crowd. She started to cry as she kissed me on the lips and wrapped her arms around my neck. I was enveloped by a giant hug from all of them. Shauna started to cry. That was unusual. I picked her up, which is not as easy as I remembered. I brushed a tear off her beautiful face. "What's wrong, sweetheart? It's okay. I'm home now." She sniffled.
"I'm sorry, Dad. I had dreams, bad dreams, about what you were doing in Estonia. I'm just so glad to see you."
She hugged me around the neck and kissed me on the cheek. I had to wipe a tear away from my cheek after such a touching admission. All I wanted now was to get home. Thankfully, the NYPD told me I could hold off on a debriefing until I got back in the office. They knew the story. The FBI would have already produced a detailed report. No doubt the mayor had told everyone not to bother me too much. I could live with that. I spent the ride from the airport to our apartment catching up on all the kids' adventures and achievements while I was gone. Bridget had started an arts and crafts club at Holy Name. She was very excited that she already had four members besides herself, five if you counted her twin, Fiona. Jane had absolutely killed an AP World History exam. There had even been an announcement at the school about how well she'd done. Juliana had won a lead role in the latest school play. It was a retro musical based on the works of Neil Diamond. They were still working out the copyright issues and realized they might have to change the names of some of the songs. I couldn't imagine what "Sweet Karen" or "I Am, I Declared" might sound like. Once we were home, I couldn't believe how relieved I was to embrace my grandfather. He, of course, had talked to Father Marty Zlotich and knew the whole story. He looked me right in the eye and said, "I know I don't say it often, but you make me very proud every day." "Often? You've never told me that. In words? In any form of communication, verbal or nonverbal, written or in any other form. How's that for being specific?"
"It just makes me more proud." "Damn. I do love that old man."
Chapter 95. Later in the evening, after I tried to spend a little time with each of the kids, we waited for a special phone call from Brian. Everyone circled around the phone, and it rang right on time. Trent snatched it off the cradle and immediately said, "Hey, Brian." Then he put it on speaker and placed the receiver back in the cradle. It was just his little way of trying to get some personal contact with his brother. I got it. Brian was upbeat and filled us in on passing more of his certifications to be an air conditioning repair mechanic. He also had started his first college courses. He said, "In case I want to earn my degree, I thought it was a good idea to get the basics out of the way now. I'm taking English and U.S. history." Chrissy said, "I'm great at history. I can help you with anything you don't understand." I liked how everyone in the room over the age of 14 effectively concealed a smile at the little girl's offer of help. Brian asked me about the trip to Estonia, but I didn't go into any detail. I was often vague about work around my family. Some people said it wasn't right to keep them sealed off from my professional life, but it was a choice I made to save them the details that no one else had to hear. We ended the call like we always did, with tears and goodbyes. But I felt pretty good about the progress Brian had made. Like I had told Natalie in Estonia, people make mistakes. Brian had made his and was doing his best to overcome them. I was proud of him, and I told him that, frequently. Sometimes in front of my grandfather, just to make a point. After the call, I sat down next to Eddie at the computer. He was working on some sort of programming problem they'd given him in the special class at Columbia he and Trent were enrolled in. He turned to me and said, "I have to say, Dad, that I've been looking at a number of the hacker forums I like to read, and some of them are talking about you." "Me? Not by name? But they make you sound like Bruce Willis.
How you stormed into Estonia and took down the biggest, baddest cyber criminal in the world. You mean the biggest, baddest cyber criminal under 5 feet 6 inches named Henry. That's the best I'll give that little twerp. Eddie laughed out loud. Although I corrected, we haven't quite brought him down yet. Just have him on the run.
It's amazing you did everything you did without knowing computers very well. You didn't have to clone any phones or crack the security on any systems, the things cybercriminals do every day.
I just did what I do every day, simple police work. You know about cloning phones?
Only in theory, I've never tried it.
Relax, this isn't an interrogation. I listened as he explained several complicated high-tech processes. I had to wonder where this kid got his brains. Finally, I said, thanks for the insight. It would have helped me in Estonia, and I appreciate the compliments, but I did what any good cop would do. Either way, I've seen more than one person talk about the American cop who dismantled a major hacker. I guess it was even on the news in Estonia.
I don't think it takes much to get on the local news in Tallinn. It's just a nice town with nice people, mostly nice people.
Eddie turned from the computer and gave me a hug. That was somewhat un-Eddie-like. He was more reserved than most of the kids. He said, I'm just glad you're back. I missed you. I missed you too. And from what I've read, you were lucky. That guy from Estonia, Henry, sounds like a really bad guy.
I don't want to give him that much credit. I'm just glad to be home and with you guys.
And that was the God's honest truth. Chapter 96. The next day I went to my office on the sixth floor of an unmarked building on the Upper West Side. I wasn't built to sit around my apartment and wait for things to happen. The kids were in school and Mary Catherine was busy, so I decided to go in and get back to my real life. I hadn't gotten official approval to return to my normal job, and I hoped no one would shout at me as I walked through the door. But everyone welcomed me back, even my lieutenant, Harry Grissom. If someone was going to tell me to get lost and take more time off, it was going to be Harry. His first concern was how well the squad operated. I'd trust him with my life, but if he thought I was going to be a detriment in any way, he'd send me home in a heartbeat. Detective Terry Hernandez was in the building, checking whether any information had developed on the suspect in her homicide. Tight. She surprised me with a hug. I stepped back and looked at her. You could pass for a college student.
That's the idea, Slick.
I laughed and we caught up on what had happened since I left. The long and the short of her investigation was that she had no other leads except for the guy I'd met, Tight. The media had kept up a pretty good pace of coverage for 3 or 4 days after the murders. A young nurse and her daughter being killed in their own apartment captured people's attention for a little longer than most stories. But now interest had ebbed in what was quickly becoming a cold homicide. Terry looked down. She was one of the most dedicated detectives I'd ever met. She checked in on a victim's family for months after a homicide, filling them in on progress. She looked at every murder as a personal quest to be solved, and she excelled in public service because she really cared. I said, we'll catch a break. This one won't haunt you.
They all haunt me, even the ones we've solved. They're murders. I think God wants them to haunt us.
That's a good point, and you're right. We shouldn't get callous toward homicides. It's too easy to start taking shortcuts if we do. I checked in with Harry and spent most of the day at my desk. In the mid-afternoon, my phone buzzed, telling me I had a text. I looked down and saw it was from the mayor's mobile phone. It said, I'm sending a car. Meet it at Riverside and 132nd Street, just a few blocks from your office. Don't say anything to anyone, the little fat prick. I had to smile at his sense of humor. I started to make my way out and nodded at Harry Grissom as I walked past his office. I took a leisurely stroll, actually looking in storefronts for a change. I saw a rented Lincoln stretched limo right where the tech said it would be. It was a little gaudy and obnoxious, but I didn't get to ride in the back of a limo very often. The driver didn't get out to meet me,
so I leaned down and waved to him. He gave me a thumbs up, and I crawled into the back. I was not the only passenger. Chapter 97. I eased into the seat and made a quick assessment of the giant passenger compartment of the limo. There was even a wet bar. Too bad I was on duty. The driver lowered the glass partition, turned his head, and said, "Hello, detective. It was lucky you two were in the same area. As soon as Natalie said she was nearby, the mayor said I could get you both at the same time." The young woman's Yankees baseball cap and big sunglasses made her look like a celebrity trying to keep a low profile. A little of her hair had popped out from under the ball cap. She looked relaxed, but didn't say anything. I said, "Hey, Natalie, you doing okay?" She nodded and said quietly, "Not thrilled about seeing my dad." I noticed the driver was eavesdropping. "I'm sure it'll be fine. You just have to give him a chance." "Like the chance to greet me at the airport?" That was disappointing. She grunted, but kept quiet after that. The driver was still listening, I knew. I asked him, "Do you work in the mayor's office?" The tubby man with slicked back, light brown hair had a slight accent. He said, "No, sir. I helped the mayor in his unofficial life. In other words, he contracted me. I guess his honor wants this meeting to be low profile." "It seems like he feels that way about most meetings." I sat back and enjoyed the ride. At this time of day, with traffic, it was going to take a while to get to City Hall. Then the driver cut east through Manhattan. It's not the way I would have gone, but he was a professional, and no one had asked my opinion. 10 minutes later, the driver made another turn, and I realized he was headed for the Queensboro Bridge. I leaned up and said, "Where are we going?" The driver focused on traffic in front of us for a moment, beeping at a tourist from Delaware who was clearly unsure where he wanted to go. Then the driver called over his shoulder, "The mayor told me to bring you to an address in Queens. I didn't ask any questions. Let me call and see if I can get any answers you might need." He pulled out his cell phone and started to speak. His conversation lasted until we were over the bridge. We were on the upper level when the driver turned off to loop around back under the bridge onto Vernon Boulevard. We passed Queens Bridge Park on our left. He was pulling past the sprawling Ravenswood power plant when he called over his shoulder, "I guess the mayor drove over here as well. He's anxious to see his daughter. He says we can meet him by Rainy Park just up here." I looked across the seat and said, "You doing okay?" She nodded, the ball cap pulled low over her face. The limo was so big that any change in speed felt like a boat moving in water. We slowed and turned down a narrow street that ran along the north of Rainy Park, some blocks past the power plant and right along the backside of a big box store. Cars were parked next to the building at first, probably those of the employees, but the driver continued to the nearly empty far end of the road, closer to the river, and stopped. I reached into my pocket for my phone. As we came to a stop, the driver looked in the rearview mirror and said, "Please, sir, no calls." "What? I'm sorry, I need to check in with my office." "I don't think so." When I looked up from my phone to see what would make the driver say something so crazy, I froze. He had turned around and held a small semi-automatic pistol in his left hand, pointed at my head. Without the man saying a word, I knew to hand over my own pistol. I reached to my right hip and slowly unholstered my Glock. I handed it over the seat to the driver. The driver said, "Phone, two." I sighed as I tossed my phone over the seat as well. The driver added, "And Natalie's purse." She handed the purse to the driver. I felt like I was back in Estonia, staring at the barrel of another gun. When was this shit gonna end? Chapter 98. As I continued to sit in the rear seat of the limo, staring at the gun, I took a moment to look at the driver more closely. He was about 40, with the smooth face of someone who hasn't worked outdoors much their whole life. He had an accent,
but I couldn't tell where he was from. In New York, you just rolled with any sort of accent. As long as you could make out the general meaning of what someone was trying to say, everyone was happy. This guy worked for Henry. He hadn't said so in words, but someone holding a gun conveys a lot with just a look. I was in deep shit. The driver kept the gun on me as he opened his door, stepped outside, and opened my door. He said, "Come on, out of the car, Detective Bennett." When I was standing with him on the asphalt, he reached into the car and raised the privacy glass. Then he hit a button that locked the doors. Before he shut my door, he leaned into the car and said, "Natalie, you sit tight for a little while. Don't even try to slip out of the car." Now, it was just the two of us. I knew that wasn't going to last for long. I asked the driver, whose head didn't come up to my nose, "What exactly is this bullshit?" The driver said,
"Henry isn't finished with you yet. He thought it was rude the way you left him in Estonia. He says you're the kind of man who should understand payback."
"What's the girl got to do with this? You could have left her alone." "Henry doesn't consult me about those kinds of decisions. I just handle problems in New York." "What's he gained from this? How is this good for business?" The driver shrugged. "I'd save those kinds of talking points for Henry. He'll be here in a minute." "Are you saying you don't think this is bullshit?" "I just understand you embarrassed Henry, and now he needs to make a statement so people know he's serious. He keeps all these cyber people in line with fear." In a crazy kind of way, that made sense. And because we were talking about a crazy person, I'm sure it made perfect sense to Henry. I noticed the new Audi rolling toward us along the street and parking maybe 50 feet away. I turned toward it, then glanced over my shoulder at the limo. There was a lot to think about in this encounter. I worked hard at keeping a disinterested expression when Henry popped out of the Audi wearing a gray Armani suit. He looked like one of the young investment bankers down on Wall Street, except for the Walther 380 pistol in his right hand. He smiled and said, "Detective Bennett, nice to see you again." "Wish I could say the same, but I'll say this, Henry, you have definitely impressed me this time. I've only been back a day and you were able to travel across the Atlantic, use the phone you cloned from the mayor, and trick me with the fake text." By the way, the little fat prick comment on the text was inspired. "Since we're complimenting each other, let me tell you how impressed I am that you were able to figure all that out on the ride over here." Now I gave him a sly smile. The guys who think they're smarter than everyone else never really see it coming. I said, "I didn't figure it out on the ride. My son pointed me in the right direction last night. The NYPD tech people confirmed it all this morning." That got Henry's attention. But it didn't seem to have quite the impact I was hoping it would. He said, "Then I guess we'll make this fast." He racked the slide on his Walther. I knew racking the gun was more to scare me, but I could tell he wasn't particularly comfortable holding the pistol. Henry looked at the driver and said, "Go get Natalie." Chapter 99. Henry and I stood in the wide gap between the two vehicles in the middle of the road, with the sun on us but the park's large trees masking us somewhat from any afternoon runners or dog walkers. A gunshot might change all that, of course. A few cars trickled by on Vernon Boulevard several hundred yards back, too far away to see what was going on down here. And probably no one from the store came back here. Plus, Henry would have easily disabled any CCTV cameras on the building. In short, it was perfect for Henry and whatever his crazy plan was. I was waiting for the driver. I'd know when it was time to act. Henry said to me, "I don't know how you convinced Natalie to betray me, but it ruined a pretty good thing." "Aw, did she break your heart?" I enjoyed watching him change colors like some kind of screwed-up chameleon. He went from his normal flesh tone to a dark red, then a purple. After a few seconds, his color returned to normal. In a much sharper tone than usual, he said, You'll learn. How do you Americans say it? Not to run your mouth?
When?
Today.
When he smiled, I realized he was back to his usual pompous self.
Good.
That made things more enjoyable and interesting.
That also made me throw in,
what if I don't learn?
Henry shook his head and mumbled,
it won't matter.
Henry, I've been around a lot of criminals in my life. The successful ones are all business. How does this help your business?
What's the point of being as successful as me if I can't do things that make me feel better?
This will make me feel better. In fact, I'm already enjoying it.
I wish I could slip you back to Estonia so I could make it last.
I smiled.
I don't see you having the stomach to torture anyone, even me.
I don't have to torture anyone. I could just let you watch as your family suffers and destroys itself while you're away.
You don't know my family. They're resilient.
Even if I ruined your credit and drained your bank accounts?
What about if I add things to your son's record and he doesn't get out of jail for 10 more years?
I tried to hide the fact that this asshole had just hit a nerve. I didn't do a very good job.
Henry chuckled. See, everyone has a weakness. Virtually all weaknesses can be exploited by something online. That's where I rule.
This isn't the internet. It's real life.
Yes, this is real.
Sometimes that's more satisfying.
He looked past me and said, here comes our other contestant.
I turned my head and had to smile at the way the driver kept a couple of feet away from his prisoner. They stopped a few steps from us. The look on Henry's face was spectacular. He stared silently for a moment. I hoped he might change colors again.
Henry said, who the hell is that?
The confused driver held up his hands and said,
it's the mayor's daughter. She was waiting right where you told me she would be.
Henry walked over and ripped off the Yankees cap. Dark hair flopped out from under it and spread out across her shoulders. I let out a laugh. It was partially to distract the two men, but there was a genuine element to it as well. I said, I thought you were too smart to be tricked by anyone. You fell for this like an 8-year-old. Allow me to introduce you to NYPD Detective Terry Hernandez. She looks a little like Natalie, I mean, in a general way, right? Your driver fell for it.
Henry worked his jaw for a moment as he backed away a few paces and then said, you forgot something, detective.
What's that?
I still have a gun.
He raised it next to his face like he was showing it to us for the first time. This time, it was Terry Hernandez who let out a laugh. She said,
so what? Your driver has a pistol, too.
Henry said, why do you find that so funny, detective? She kept a smile on her pretty face. Then she threw me a wink. She said,
you think I wasn't ready for that?
Without any warning, she stepped right next to the driver and hit the trigger of a taser she had hidden under her dress. She used it like an old-style stun gun by jamming it into the driver's side and pulling the trigger. He let out a squawk and immediately dropped to the ground. His pistol skittered away from his outstretched arms. He convulsed for a few seconds, drawing everyone's attention. A thin line of spit dribbled out of his open mouth. His eyes rolled back, giving him the look of a quivering zombie. Henry was distracted for a moment. Most people have never seen a taser deployed. It's an interesting show. Then he regained his common sense and faced me with the pistol once again. Chapter 100. The afternoon sun was over my shoulder now and in Henry's eyes. Good. I needed any advantage. I wasn't about to let Henry point that gun at me again. Before he'd even brought it on target, I stepped closer and slapped it out of his hand. I have to admit my initial response was to punch him in the face, but at the last second, I realized I needed to eliminate the pistol from the equation. I wasn't worried about Terry Hernandez. She was as smart and as tough as any cop I had ever met. She was also impressively efficient. She was on top of the stunned driver even before I'd slapped a pistol away from Henry. I did something I never do. I gave a prisoner a chance to fight his way into an escape. I faced off against Henry and let him see that my hands were empty. It's not a smart tactical move, and not what a cop should do. But this little son of a bitch had caused me a lot of heartache, and I'd let him run his mouth on two different continents. Now, it was time that he learned a lesson. We squared off. I was going to give this young Estonian a chance to show me just how his showy beach muscles would help him in a fight. Big biceps had never helped in a street fight. Henry raised both of his hands and balled them into fists. Then he started to dance like a boxer. He was loose and casual. It looked pretty good. He danced and circled away from me a few feet, throwing a quick left jab out into space. I turned and adjusted to close the distance between us. He danced a little farther. Then I lunged at him. I used my long legs to really cover some distance, but Henry easily skipped backward, and somehow now there was even more room between us. Terry Hernandez shouted something at me. She sounded muffled and far away, but I couldn't take my attention off the feisty young Estonian. For another 20 seconds, all of it spent in frustration, Henry kept dancing just outside the range of my fists. We covered the majority of what was left of the road, and now the East River was not far from me. I was close enough to smell it. I also had sweat trickling into my eyes. This was turning into a regular workout. The only problem was that Henry didn't look like he was working as hard as me. Henry planted his feet, and right at that moment, I realized the joke was on me. He had purposely led me away from any backup. I realized immediately that Terry Hernandez had shouted for me to keep close just in case. I was an idiot, and Henry's smug smile didn't make me feel any better. Now he cracked his knuckles and peeked over my shoulder to make sure we were far enough away from Terry. Then Henry said, "I love so many things about America." He almost shouted it. He was showing me he wasn't nervous. Oddly, I felt a flutter of nerves. But I stayed in his game and said, "It's nice when visitors appreciate the country." I sucked in a little extra oxygen. This would be a longer fight than I had anticipated. Henry said, "I love the freedoms and wealth as much as I love the hypocrisy of Americans. You have this vast continent, yet everyone crams onto an insignificant little island like Manhattan. Why is that? It feels like something lemmings would do." He slowly circled me as he kept talking. Now it was Henry who was looking for an opening. "I also like how you let lawyers and the threat of lawsuits govern your behavior more than the government. And especially I like how you are all utterly convinced that the world needs you. Like you'll ride to the rescue if there's a problem." He threw a few more punches in the air. Then he looked right at me and changed his tone. "You know what else I love? What's that? Your media outlets have to fill time with drivel. Every detail of the lives of celebrities is broadcast at all hours. Every aspect of police investigations is reported, like the stories on your recent shooting, the one where you gunned down an innocent youth for no reason. You know what that tells me? That you watch too much TV?" He gave me a polite smile and shook his head. "No, it tells me that no matter what happens between us, you won't use a gun. Even if you grabbed one, it would look too bad for you. The day I need a gun to deal with a little punk like you is the day I retire. If you ever get a chance to retire." Chapter 101. I had listened to this bullshit long enough. The smartass had been asking for a lesson in manners for a long time and had traveled a long way to get it. I didn't have thoughts like that often, but this was a fight I had been waiting for. I held my right hand just behind my right leg as I balled it into a fist. I pictured hitting the computer genius so hard, I knocked him into the river behind him. Maybe my expectations were a little high. Henry fainted with his left hand, then threw a hard, round kick right into my ribs. It knocked the wind out of me and shook my confidence at the same time. As I sucked in air hard, I realized I hadn't expected him to be so good with his feet. Henry gave me a smile and said, "I do a lot to stay in shape, lift weights, run, and I've been studying Taekwondo with a master in Estonia. I finally got to use it. Too bad I couldn't find a more worthy opponent." To emphasize his comment, he made a quick turn and caught me in the stomach with a spinning back kick. I took a few steps back to give me some distance. I had to suck in as much air as possible. This guy was full of surprises. I didn't want this to be his final one, but it wasn't like I'd never been in a fight. I was a New York City police detective. I had a great reach advantage if I could just keep him from using his feet. I had to think. Henry charged me and leapt into the air to deliver a kick to my head. I swung hard with my left arm and knocked him onto the asphalt half a dozen feet from me. He didn't scramble to get up like I thought he might, but he did make it to his feet and faced me again. I said, "Maybe your time would have been better spent studying a Japanese martial art like Shotokan. More practical, lower to the ground. No fancy moves like that, but it might not work with a little short guy like you." Again, I noticed his face change color. My comment had exactly the effect I wanted it to. He let out a low growl as he stepped toward me and raised his right fist like he was going to punch me. This time I was ready for the fake. I moved my left arm slightly, but as soon as his foot came off the ground, I shifted my weight and used both of my forearms to block the kick. I didn't know how a guy that size generated so much power. Maybe it was from his anger. Either way, I was glad the kick hadn't landed on a rib or my chin. He danced away from me, and we squared off again. I said, "Aren't you getting tired yet? I'd like to wrap this up. I have a lot left to do today." This time, as he came at me, he kicked low. Very low. It caught me right on the shin. I was shocked how much pain shot through my system. I tried to hop back, but he was on me. An elbow crashed into my temple. This fight was definitely not unfolding the way I had expected. Chapter 102. As I breathed hard and did my own dancing to get a little farther away from Henry, I glanced around the street, wondering where the reinforcements were. Then Henry forced me to focus on the fight again. I managed to parry two hard punches aimed at my face. Now sweat was starting to pour into my eyes, and the pain from the kicks to my ribs and my shin intensified. I felt my breath become labored, my vision blurred. I needed a change in tactics. I gained a little more distance, backing farther away from Henry. He had a real swagger about him now. He was enjoying this. Maybe he thought he was putting on a show. Too bad for him there was no one around to see it. I would have gladly led him back to Terry Hernandez if I thought he'd bite on that idea. I also realized that if I went for my gun, with his speed, he'd be all over me. Henry took a big step to his left, then spun and kicked me with his right foot. It hit me high, just above the solar plexus. At least a blow like that in my chest didn't knock the wind out of me. I took the kick and stepped back, then slipped to one knee. This was not the position I wanted to be in. Henry let out a laugh. "This feels about right. You kneeling before me. Now all you need to do is ask for mercy." "Does that mean you'll show me mercy?" "What do you think?" He swung his left leg high over his head to bring an axe kick down on my shoulders. It was a lot easier to do something like that when your opponent was on his knee. At the last moment, I rolled to one side and avoided the kick. But I could feel the effects of the fight catching up to me. I tried to clear my head. I was still on the ground, and now my limbs were shaky. Henry jumped to one side so he could attack me from behind. This time, instead of blows, he wrapped his arm around my neck. I felt his other arm brace my head. He had me in a solid chokehold. This was the last place a cop wanted to be. He leaned in close as he used his arms to slowly cut off my air. He whispered in my ear,
"Not what you expected, is it? I don't know about you, but I don't like surprises."
That's when I reverted to what we like to call non-conventional street tactics. It really wasn't that hard either. As he shifted to get a better position on his choke, his groin ended up next to my shoulder. I wasted no time in making a fist and punching him in the balls as hard as I could. I could tell by the way he released me instantly and the sound he made that I had been right on target. I rose to my feet as he staggered back, holding his crotch the entire way. He worked hard to shake off the blow. I used the time to catch my breath. He came at me again, only this time much slower. I blocked a right cross, and while he was close to me, I headbutted him in the face. I felt his nose shatter. I'd caught him with the top of my forehead just the way you're supposed to. He staggered back. His eyes weren't focused. After three steps, he flopped onto the ground, then laid down like he needed a nap. I resisted the urge to kick him while he was on the ground, but I wasn't a big enough man to resist standing over him with my hands on my knees so we were looking at each other and saying, "I guess all those brains couldn't cushion a good headbutt. You're under arrest." Terry Hernandez led her dazed prisoner over to me. She held two of his interlocked fingers on his head, an old trick for holding people if you didn't have handcuffs close by. She said, "You okay?" All I could do was nod. Terry said, "He wasn't a bad fighter. Clearly, he was never a street fighter." I couldn't even answer verbally. I just nodded. Three cars turned from Vernon Boulevard and came in a line down the street, then angled in different directions as they stopped, blocking off the street completely. I knew it was Harry Grissom and the rest of our squad. I was happy to sit with my prisoner and let my colleagues handle the rest. Chapter 103. I brushed myself off and wiped some blood from my nose. Two junior detectives took custody of Henry. One of them checked his eyes and made sure he was fully conscious and coherent. When the detective nodded, the other detective said, "Do you speak English?" When Henry didn't answer, the detective repeated the question in a much louder voice. Somehow NYPD personnel viewed that as a universal language. This time, Henry nodded as he stared at the ground. A few drops of blood leaked from a cut on his lip. The detective immediately said, "You have the right to remain silent." I tuned out the rest of the Miranda warning as Harry Grissom joined me and put an arm around my shoulders. As we started to walk away from Henry and the two detectives, I had to say to Harry, "Just a little late, huh, Harry?" The lieutenant laughed. "I'll admit the move to Queens threw us off. I can't believe I let you talk me into this crazy plan. You and Hernandez could have been killed." "And we could be killed every day. The plan worked. That's what's important." "But thank God your brainiac kid knew about cloned phones. The GPS unit in your pocket worked pretty well. At least now we can let Natalie London out of protective custody and give her back her phone. The mayor should be thrilled." I shook my head. The mayor was nothing like I expected him to be, but I don't give a damn if he's thrilled or not. Turns out, I didn't do this for him. Natalie's a sweet kid. She's got a bright future. I'm just glad she didn't waste it on an asshole like Henry. A few minutes later, as the two detectives were about to transport Henry to booking, I couldn't resist taking a moment to chat with my Estonian friend. I opened the rear door and kneeled down so I could look in on the handcuffed computer genius. He looked beaten, with his hands secured behind him, sitting in the back of a Crown Vic with a plexiglass shield separating the front seat from the rear. He surprised me by speaking first. He said, "I underestimated you." I said, "And I overestimated you. Let's call it even." "What now?" He You'll face a slew of federal charges, and then we'll throw in the attempted murder, plus all the murders you've ordered. So I wouldn't plan any exotic trips. You're going to be occupied for a good, long time. Henry smiled. I'm glad you feel satisfied. I hope it lasts. What's that supposed to mean? You've made a huge mistake. It's funny that you think I'll be in prison for a long time. Last I checked, prisons had computers. I still have friends. I have more money than you can comprehend. I won't be out of circulation long. Should I be scared? I don't feel it right now. You will. Trust me. No one will keep me locked up for very long. I patted him on the shoulder. You keep those positive thoughts. Frankly, it's a nice change from the I'm innocent excuse I usually hear. I shut the door and watched the car pull away. Chapter 104. A couple of days later, when I walked into the mayor's office, I still carried a few cuts on my face and a black eye. That's what was obvious. I also had a cracked rib and a broken finger. It doesn't sound like much, but it was enough to remind me of what had happened more than once a minute. Of course, as soon as I confirmed that the mayor's phone and email had been compromised, the NYPD cybercrime unit had gone into overdrive. Every city phone and computer had to be checked and double-checked. It was as if no one had ever heard of cybercrime, and now that some asshole from Estonia had broken the meager security on the mayor's phone, the government's role was to overreact. It felt familiar. Now, as I sat in an overstuffed leather chair waiting for the mayor to come into his office, the past few weeks seemed to catch up with me all at once. This felt like real closure. With any luck, this would be the last time I ever had to talk to the mayor face to face. That was the sincere wish of most NYPD employees. I heard the mayor before the inner door to his office opened. He wore his usual tailored suit, which did nothing to hide his belly. He greeted me with a big smile and came right to my chair to shake my hand. He said, "Look, it's my favorite NYPD detective." After he shook my hand, he held it for extra awkward seconds. I guess he was trying to show me how much he appreciated everything I'd done. "You did a great job in Estonia, and the way you figured out that my phone had been hacked was brilliant. Thank you so much for bringing Natalie back to us." "How's she doing?" I know she wasn't very happy about being held in protective custody, or whatever we called it. The mayor plopped into the plush leather chair behind his wide oak desk. He looked down and was silent for a few moments. When he looked up at me again, he said, "I'm sure Natalie told you we have a few issues. She's not ready to talk to me just yet. I'm trying to be patient. But her mother tells me she's doing quite well. The reason I asked you to visit today was to show my appreciation. I can tell you that officially you've been cleared of any wrongdoing in your shooting. In connection to that, I spoke to the esteemed Reverend Franklin Caldwell. He's agreed to stop his protest directed at you." "How did you manage that?" "The Reverend and I have a good working relationship. I assured him that backing off your case will help him in the future. His living depends on getting a cut of all the settlements the city makes on cases he's involved in. It's not a great system, but it's worked in the past." I almost asked the mayor why he hadn't had the Reverend stop the protest as soon as the mayor knew my shooting was justified. I figured he'd just have some slick reply like, "We have to pick our battles." And this wasn't the battle I wanted him to fight. Now I had the real question, the one that had floated just below the surface since my last chat with the mayor. I said, "Were you able to talk to anyone about my son Brian? That's all I really care about." The mayor patted his belly. "So it comes back to children. It seems like that's always the case. My daughter brought me to you. Your son motivates you." "Did I motivate you enough to make some phone calls?" The mayor smiled. "I can see why you're so effective. So I won't beat around the bush. I did talk to some Department of Corrections people and the Attorney General. The responses were not overly optimistic. They don't want it to look like favoritism by releasing the son of a prominent police officer.
So that's it?
I'm still trying. Let's give it a little time. May I speak freely, Mr. Mayor? I didn't think you had any other way of speaking. But please, say anything you want. It won't leave this room. I didn't just try to find your daughter. I did it. I didn't give up. Now you know what it's like to have a child returned to you. Please consider that in your efforts to get Brian released. I don't need you to try to get Brian released. I need you to put as much effort into it as I did in finding your daughter. The mayor stared straight ahead silently, nodding his head slowly.
Well said, detective. Well said.
Chapter 105. My cell phone rang on the nightstand, waking me from a dream about playing basketball with LeBron James, and I was winning. Startled, I automatically reached out with my left hand and fumbled for the phone before it rang again. Mary Catherine barely stirred next to me as I said, "Bennett, this better be good." I managed a quick peek out the window. It was still pitch black outside. I glanced at my alarm clock and realized it was only 5:30 in the morning. The call was important enough to get me moving quickly. Mary Catherine called from the bed when she started to stir. I said, "I want to take a day trip. You guys have been cooped up in the city too long. I'll get the kids moving. You get dressed." Her voice was still scratchy with sleep.
"A day trip? Where, Michael? What are you talking about?"
Even without me answering, she got up and started to get dressed. That's trust. It took a little longer to get the kids in order, but that allowed me to call my grandfather. And even though it was by then after 6 in the morning, he was still quite annoyed. But he agreed to be ready to go in 20 minutes. It wasn't even 7 o'clock by the time we were pulling away from Holy Name in the van. The rapid-fire questions started coming from everyone. "Where are we going? Why couldn't we keep sleeping? When will we get there? When can we eat?" I shut everyone up with a quick run to McDonald's, then let nature take its course, and I gave a satisfied smile once everyone fell back to sleep. Everyone except Seamus. And he was smart enough to not ask any questions. A little over an hour and a half after we'd eaten, about half the kids woke up. Jane, my second oldest daughter, looked out the window of the van and said,
"Isn't this the way to Fishkill?"
Trent said,
"Where the prison is?"
Fiona, with a higher pitch of excitement in her voice, said,
"Oh, we're going to visit Brian, right?"
I smiled and said, "Do I ever have some bright kids?" Now everyone was awake, and excitement rippled through the van. There were no more complaints now that they all knew the reason we'd gotten moving so early. But the real surprise for my family was yet to come. They knew the drill: go into the prison, check in, wait, move to the visiting area, wait, get to see Brian. Today the drill was thrown off. We were immediately led to a community room with no guards, partitions, or closed-circuit telephones. There were more questions, but everyone filed into the room dutifully. That's why, when a door on the other side of the room opened, everyone just stood in shock. 3 corrections officers entered the room, followed by Brian. He was wearing jeans and a collared shirt, holding a duffel bag crammed with everything he owned. Mary Catherine said,
"What's this?"
Brian dropped his bag and ran right to me for a big hug. All I could manage to say as the weight of my grown son pushed me back onto a couch was, "Brian's coming home." I would have given more explanation, but I started to cry. Before I could be self-conscious about crying in front of corrections officers, everyone in my family started to cry, and they piled on me and Brian. My glimpse of the corrections officers told me they liked the happy scene. They all smiled and clapped. My grandfather had to sit at the end of the couch just to catch his breath. The combination of excitement and joy had worn out the old man. Seamus asked,
"How did this happen? It has to be the hand of God."
I couldn't speak with everyone piled on top of me, but it was better that way, because Brian was released with the help of God. That's the only way I could view it. God helped me find Natalie and rescue her. He certainly protected us during our escape, and that led the mayor to work extra hard and push for Brian's release. The mayor's pressure and the work Brian had done on a drug case against a cartel had led to an early parole. Part of it might have been the failure of the Department of Corrections to keep Brian safe when he was attacked by cartel members last year, but it didn't matter. Only one thing mattered at this moment. Brian was coming home. Chapter 106. Once we got Brian home, I took a few extra days off. It might have been the most joy-filled week of my life, and that includes the week before every Christmas as a kid. Brian was home and was still himself, although he was not the boy who'd left us. Prison can do crazy things to people. It can twist them and distort their view of reality, or cause a depression that never leaves. One of the common threads I'd seen among convicted felons was a victim mentality. It's counterintuitive, but prevalent. Released felons believe they were unfairly targeted by the police, while others get away with everything. Brian accepted his mistakes and was ready to move on. He'd taken what the correction system had offered in classes and training. It had made me proud in an odd kind of way. He was already looking for air conditioning companies he might be able to work for, and he blended back into the family fairly easily. The boys played basketball at Holy Name, where the faculty seemed thrilled to see Brian home. My grandfather and I sat in the bleachers and watched Brian, Trent, Eddie, and Ricky play for hours. On the third day after Brian's release, Seamus turned to me in the bleachers and said, "You did a great job raising these kids. I'm proud to be part of your family." I waited for the punchline. Then I realized the old man was sincere. I draped my arm around his bony shoulders and said a silent prayer of thanks. What else is there to do when you realize all the blessings God has given you? I went back to work a couple of days before I had intended to, but it was for a good reason. My informant Flash had gotten word to me that he might have found the suspect in the murder of the nurse and her daughter, the elusive Tite. Usually, a suspect like Tite would have some kind of record, and assault charge is common. Those kinds of charges always get pleaded down, but there would still be a record. But we had nothing on him, not in either police intelligence or arrest files. Flash told me he was supposed to meet Tite at Convent Garden on 151st Street up near Washington Heights, one of the places where Flash and I usually met. It was quiet and comfortable and, from a tactical standpoint, suitable for a quick arrest. Even though I had worked with Flash for a few years and I knew his real name was Evis Tolder, I didn't tell anyone else what was going on. Informants are notoriously unreliable, and I didn't want to waste anyone's time. I thought about calling Terry Hernandez, but if things went south, I didn't want her in the trick bag. She had a bright future ahead of her. I decided if I was able to grab Tite, I'd call her, and she could take the collar. The second reason, as important as the first, was my overwhelming need to be the cop who put cuffs on this killer. I thought back to the murder scene of the nurse and her daughter, with those giant holes the .45 slugs had made in their heads. I saw them at night when I started to fall asleep. I also remembered Tite goading the young man who'd robbed me. Without Tite, it would have been a simple robbery, and we both would have walked away. As soon as I met Flash, he said, "Did you bring the 2K for the pills he wants to sell?" "Nice try. This is not a dope case. We don't have to do any kind of deal. As soon as I see him, I'm going to grab him. That's the end of this caper today. Understood?" Flash looked troubled. Finally, he said, "Then you'll throw some cash my way afterward." I said, Have I ever stiffed you on information you gave me? That seemed to satisfy my informant. He told me everything he'd done to find Tite. It wasn't much. He had been lucky and had met the pill addict at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Now he was supposed to buy a few $1,000s worth of pills from Tite. Once we got to Convent Garden, I made Flash wait at the far end of the park. No one was inside the fence, and I was able to sit on a bench across the park without being seen easily. I ran through the drill in my head quickly. Once I grabbed Tite, I could charge him with attempted robbery. I could articulate how he had been part of the robbery with RJ and had fled after the shooting. Then, Terry Hernandez would have to tie him to the homicide. If he had his pistol on him, we could match the slugs. Otherwise, it might be up to DNA. I sat quietly, looking across the park until about 3:20. I wasn't worried that our target hadn't shown up yet. He was working on DST, Doper Standard Time. Addicts rarely stuck to schedules. It was one of the things that made it so hard to work in the narcotics unit. Then I looked up, and he was there. Standing by the entrance to the park, the tall black man was all shakes and jitters. The time since the murder had not been kind to him. A threadbare coat over ripped sweatpants hardly made the profession of drug dealer look glamorous. His eyes darted in every direction, and he never stopped moving. He noticed Flash and began shambling toward him. I immediately stood up and started to stroll through the park, headed in the general direction of the two men. I had already told Flash to just walk away once I showed up. No chit-chat, no staying to watch, just leave the area. It was the safest thing to do. And that way, I didn't have to worry about Flash getting hurt. I approached the two men at an angle where Tite couldn't see me. They talked for a few seconds. I stood directly behind them. As soon as Tite turned around, Flash started to walk away. I couldn't believe an informant had actually listened to directions. I smiled at Tite. Remember me? His right hand reached for his waistband. But I was ready. My Glock was in my right hand behind my back. I reached out and pinned his arm with my left hand, then brought my pistol up to where it was almost touching his nose. I said, I guess that means you do remember me. Do you remember Sandra Evans and her daughter Alicia? I yanked the pistol from his waistband. I stuck it in the back of my belt before I shoved him to the ground and put cuffs on him. When he was securely in custody, I carefully pulled the pistol from my back. It was the same Colt 45 I had seen the day I was in the shooting. I had the right man. Tite screamed, "Police brutality! Help me! Help me!" I pulled him to his feet and dusted him off. Relax, Tite. The whole park has video surveillance. You need to find a new excuse. Instantly, he shifted gears and said, I've been framed! I've been framed! Well, that's why we have a judicial system. If I'm wrong, you go free and can sue me. But if I'm right, you're done. That's when he tried to wiggle free and run. I had to catch him hard by the elbow, then swing him onto a bench a few feet away. Finally, the fight went out of him. He sighed and started to cry. Through the tears, he said, I need help, man. I don't even know who I am no more. I'll be sure to tell Mrs. Evans that. Who? The woman whose daughter and granddaughter you shot, the nurse. Do you remember her? I've seen a lot of murders, but this is one where I just have to ask you, why? It made no sense to me. He sat there staring straight ahead into the park, deep in thought. Finally, he turned his head to look at me and said, She had access to pills. I said, Excuse me? Tite said, She was the nurse in charge of securing the painkillers and such. I thought she could load me up. She didn't like the idea of doing something like that. So you killed her? And her daughter. He hung his head and said, I don't remember it so clearly. I don't remember nothing so clearly. And I don't really care. I don't care if you shoot me right here, take me to jail, or let me go. Nothing matters no more.
It may not matter to you, but it matters a lot to the Evans family. And they're going to be happy to see you behind bars.
Good. Make those people happy for a few minutes seeing me behind bars.
I'm sure that's what everyone will say about you, that he just wanted to make the world a better place. I walked him through the park in handcuffs. I called Terry Hernandez and told her to meet me in front of the Manhattan North Homicide building. I wanted to dump this mope and get on with my real life. There were 10 kids at home waiting to see me. This has been a Hachette audio production of Blindside. Written by James Patterson and James O'Born. Read by Danny Mastrogiorgio. Produced by Robert Van Kolken. Directed by Gordon Rothman. Engineered by Justin Kilpatrick. Recorded at Merlin Studios. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Blindside is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2020 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the rights of free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.